That's your beer theme song, just the two of us.
You're two doing buzzers.
Yeah.
Boom, doom, 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 boom.
Boom, ba doo, boo, ba doo, boo, ba doo, boo.
Hello, I'm Ted Leo.
And I'm Amy Mann.
Welcome to The Art of Process,
where we discuss how form and structure and organization is part of the magic of the creative process, the underrated underbelly of the creative process. Can an underbelly be underrated?
I was just about to say, it might be the first underrated underbelly in the history of underbellies. Although, I mean, I've seen many a cute underbelly, I got to say. You're not usually referred to as, you're usually just referred to as a belly.
I feel like you're, when you are saying underbelly, what you're thinking of is cute little stretched out kitties showing their cute little fluffy underbellies.
Yeah, or like a fish with a like a blorpy fish, like a dolphin or something, whale rolling over.
Well, some of those underbellies are underrated. That's what we're discussing.
It's, hang on a second, though. Those are just bellies. So what's an underbelly?
I guess it's like a belly under... An underbelly would be a belly under a belly.
Is the underbelly the street? Is that what we've really been talking about? Like, let's say there's a rat, which, by the way, rats have an underrated, cute belly.
Uh-huh. Very underrated, possibly not rated at all.
Except by rat owners. There are a lot of enthusiastic rat owners out there. But so when you say the underbelly, are you talking about what's under what a rat is crawling on? In other words, like it's lower than the rats, like it's the slime in the streets.
I think it's like when you pick up the rock, what's under that? And yeah. So if like a rock had a belly.
Right. The under, yeah, the belly of the rock. You're in the belly of the rock now with us.
Anyway, that's what our podcast is about.
This week, we had the pleasure of talking to musician and songwriter Dan Wilson. Dan is, to many of us, I think, probably known best for some of the bands he was in, Trip Shakespeare, and then, of course, Semisonic, who had the gigantic hit with Closing Time, which is now stuck in all of your heads and will be for a long time to come. But he also has an incredibly successful career as a songwriter, and he's worked with many, many names that are, let's just say, much bigger on the festival poster than either mine or yours, Amy.
Yes, we're always in like the second or third tent.
Yeah, sometimes we're in the underbelly of the festival poster. Yeah. I first met Dan when the three of us were part of a charity event at a large house in Los Angeles a year and a half ago or so. It was an incredibly, incredibly hot day, and I remember we had the choice of either standing in the sun, but where there was air movement, or under this tent where you were out of the sun, but where there was no air movement. So it was sort of like fry or slow bake. And any sane person, to my mind, would choose a slow bake.
Yeah, fry or a convection oven. The other thing I remember about that was the refreshments. In the cooler, the only snack was yogurt, which... just seemed like a very unrefreshing, like in a very hot outdoor tent, it feels like a fermented dairy product is not the best, it's not the most cooling choice.
I think my preferred use for that would have been to spread it on myself to protect from the sun rather than actually ingest yogurt on such a day. But Dan was there, and I remember sitting on a couch in that tent and just falling into conversation with him, and he was so kind and had led such an interesting life and was such a generous conversationalist that he was one of the first names that came to mind when we had the idea of doing this podcast.
I agree with that. And without further ado, here is Dan Wilson. Oh my God,
cool.
We're starting.
This
is terrifying.
Start being awesome now.
Where are my notes?
Dan, thank you so much for doing this with us to jump right in.
Mm-hmm.
You and Amy you've met in the past a number of times before, right?
Our paths have crossed every now and then since like 1983?
That sounds right.
Yeah. I feel like we played together in one of Boston's many, many clubs that, you know, it was like a restaurant bar. In the back, there was music. That's, I sort of remember you. I still remember.
Bunratty's or something like that. Or one,
yeah. Not even, I don't even think it's
not even
as,
that.
Like, not even as rock clubby as that. Yeah. There's a song that you played that I remember to this day from hearing it one time. So to me, that really qualifies you as like an extraordinary kind of songwriter, you know, because I feel like back then people just weren't, myself included, weren't really writing songs. And so it was unusual to come across somebody who was writing songs with melody and lyrics that actually meant something.
In that band that I had with my brother Matt and I were both really into somehow the idea of being songwriters, you know, mm-hmm. in addition to being in a band.
Uh-huh.
Like it was definitely a full-sized conceptual part of what we were doing.
Well, that's interesting because I think that's, I mean, it's interesting and seems obvious that that's a qualification. To,
right, you'd think.
Yeah, that you want to be, that's something that's valuable to you is to be a songwriter and to think about what that means to you. What did that mean to you at that point and how has that gone along? Like a sort of craftsmanship element?
I think when I was starting out in bands, the things that attracted me were never really bandy. Like, I was into, as a kid, I was into Led Zeppelin very much. Mm-hmm. But I was not into the idea of being anything like Led Zeppelin. It just didn't even occur. That seemed like another world entirely, to be a band type of band. Mm.
Right.
And so the things that I gravitated to were always more like Elvis Costello, which is like sort of band-like, but really even back then he was like a singer-songwriter kind of spruced up as a band guy.
Yeah,
right.
You know, yeah.
It was like more like a huge loud voice with this kind of rocking band way in the background.
Yeah.
And even Joni Mitchell being like one of my sort of idols and Carole King, I just always had more of a focus on the songwriter icon almost.
That's interesting because at that point in time, in retrospect, historically, we think of it as more of a band time, like the era of the 70s singer-songwriter was kind of, you know, sunsetting at least.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
But there really were a couple of parallel streams happening because most of the thrust of the punk thing was about being in a band, you
yeah.
know, and
yeah.
even sublimating your identity as a songwriter to the identity of the band.
Yeah.
But at the same time, with a foot in that world, you had Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello
yeah.
and people like that who had no problem playing under their own name.
But it's true that they did have kind of a band feel. You know, they had the best of both worlds. And I do, you know, my memories of the sort of early 80s was that everything was kind of band-oriented. There wasn't a lot of, you know, the idea of singer-songwriter wasn't really, I don't know, even like Bruce Springsteen, he had a band
it's
and
true.
He had a band
yeah.
sound.
Mm-hmm.
I think of, like, the thing that's running in my mind right now is I'll Stop the World and Melt With You.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
a kind of, the texture and the vibes of bandishness, like The Cure and things like that. I even have sort of a strong memory in the Semisonic days of accidentally telling my A&R guy that I wanted to make records that were like rock records, but secretly they were Simon and Garfunkel records.
Yeah.
And he was so upset and angry about this.
Oh my God.
Because it sounded like death to him.
That sounds fantastic to me.
That sounds pretty good.
That sounds pretty perfect.
Yeah, it was like doom to him for some reason. He was wrong, but it really scared him.
Right.
So part of what we talk about is people's process. And at what point did you start to see structure or encounter structure in songwriting and in lyric writing? And what did that look like to you? And or did it just come so naturally that you didn't really think about it?
No, it didn't come naturally. I think what I was doing early on was trying to write and play things that sounded like stuff that I liked. I was trying to write things that sounded like the Beatles or Elvis Costello or Joni Mitchell. And I slowly started to figure out the form and structure of those people's songs. I never would have realized, for example, that the Joni Mitchell songs that I love the best are just a sort of a circuitous looping series of ideas that then repeats.
Uh-huh.
Like it doesn't feel like verse, chorus, you know, hook, bridge. It's more like a minute long loop of things that then she starts again. And it doesn't have a pop structure at all. Yeah. And I only realized that because I was trying to figure out how to write a song like her.
Right.
And then almost like the opposite, like the Costello records that I was listening to, I started realizing that like Hand in Hand by Costello, it starts out with a thing that's very obviously a verse and has a verse-like structure. And then it does a kind of Beach Boys drum beat pre-chorus section that's a different kind of chanty little hook. And then there's a thing that's obviously a chorus, you know, after that. Mm-hmm. You could really see his the chunks of what he was doing as I started to like analyze. And my brother Matt started to decide that that was because people like that had little pieces of music laying around that you could, if they were in the same tempo, you could just put them after one another.
I mean, that's not necessarily wrong. Like,
I know.
I mean, I don't think I've done much of it, but I've probably done it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've probably said like, I wonder if this chunk will.
Wait a minute. Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So I figured out the structural thing partly just by trying to copy those artists that whose writing I thought was cool.
Right. So, yeah. And we talk a lot about imitation as a way that people often start out. My first efforts were like, I just want to write a thing that sounds like a song.
Yeah.
Write lyrics that sound like lyrics. And, and then in the service of doing that, you end up kind of writing lyrics that sound like other people's lyrics.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, just to get something on paper and and it takes a while to kind of figure out what fits and what doesn't. What do you think you kept from the people you were imitating? What do you think that you ended up rejecting?
Well, I think part of what I kept was the idea that it was doable. Because once I could see them at work, I realized it was just people trying to do something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and then so I was starting to piece together. It seemed so mystique-filled and impossible at first to get from where I was at with no ability or skill to where they were at, which was this mystical mountaintop. But then when I started to see what they were up to, I realized, well, there might even have been songs where I was like, I wouldn't have put that section there.
Yeah.
And at that point, I started to realize, oh, they're just doing stuff like I am, you know.
Going back to what you were saying about the little pieces of that song, and specifically to get real inside baseball, I think that understanding the value or the ways to use a pre-chorus as such is, you know, it's kind of something you have to learn a little bit. And it does unlock a whole puzzle that you then realize, this is why that hook works so much better than had it just abutted against
the previous
verse or something. And, you know, being able to take some of those tools along with you and then squeeze your own voice out through that somehow.
There's two mysteries about it that I can kind of vaguely pinpoint when this one happened, which is, yes, you know, you're sort of trying to copy, and if you got audacious enough to start a band and then you wanted to have original songs and then suddenly you have this task to write a whole bunch of songs, and so you're just banging out songs just to do the show that you said you were going to do. And some of it's very functional and very, you know, instead of you're trying to glorify yourself, but, you know, there is something to do with like, well, I got to fill up 45 minutes because we agreed to do this show. So then how does it go backwards to where those tools or abilities or kind of that emulation opens up something soulful, like a channel to your own soulfulness.
Right.
Yeah.
And your own pains and joys start bleeding into the music. I don't know how that happens. That's like a mystery to me.
Well, I'm going to tell you, know, I'm going to say this might be putting too much into it, but you kind of just described what a lot of rituals do in other aspects of life, whether it's a religious service or something else. There are these forms that are repeated and they have been developed over thousands and thousands of years that, you know, not always, but sometimes actually do enable one to transcend a little bit your immediate surroundings and tap into that ineffable thing that you're trying to express.
Yeah, there really is something about learning a skill. I mean, it's a kind of language that you learn, and eventually you learn it enough to be able to say some things. But there is a kind of magic that happens, I think, that when you really pay attention to the details of it, to the just the building blocks of it, the chop wood, carry water aspect of it, that something, you know, then this extra thing does happen, but it takes a long time.
I had a really wonderful kind of artistic growing phase in the early 90s, early to mid 90s, and I was friends with a playwright, still am, And he was a songwriter as well. And we never talked about the nuts and bolts. But I started paying attention to playwriting. I've never done it myself. But I started paying attention to it because I started to realize, well, there's a certain thing that they do. For example, if there's an intermission, there's a certain thing that they do where like a door opens and one more character walks back on that has been off stage for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. Yeah, another door opens up and another character walks on and says something else, you know, dire. Finally, one last person stands up and says the ultimate dire thing. And then the lights go out and it's time for the intermission. And then everyone's hair is standing on end at that point because it's just been this crescendo of meaning and implication and consequences. Yeah. And then the lights go out and it's such a formal thing. It's like when they're writing the play, they're like, mwah, ha, 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 this is a great thing for that last person to say in the play before the intermission. You know, bang, the lights come out and you're like completely blown away in the audience. But when writing the play itself, the people are following almost like a time-honored sequence that leads to that like tension-filled, suspenseful intermission, talking in the lobby kind of vibe.
Right.
And songs are totally like that too. I kind of learned that from my friend Craig in a way that songs have this, they're like a tiny casual play, but they still have that quality of, you can tap into the sequence of things that leads to a dramatic feeling, you know, and do it consciously in a way.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with The Art of Process.
Greetings, I am Plek Dexsetter, contacting you from the Zix Squadron, which is frankly sort of crappy, but I'm here on a heroic mission with my trusty crew, C-53.
Heroic feels like an exaggeration.
Okay, sure. And Security Officer Dar.
Plek, don't put me in your stupid recording.
Well, and we're all traveling aboard our trusty starship, the Bargerian Jade. Bargy.
What? Sorry, I'm awake. I was just flying while asleep.
Hey there, this is Alden Ford. I play Plek, and we are so excited to announce that our podcast, Mission to Zix, is now part of the Maximum Fun Network. Our third season launches on Max Fun on March 20th. Binge seasons 1 and 2 right now. That's Mission to Zix, ZYXX.
You know, I don't want to be too reductivist about it, but I think that there are a lot of ways of thinking about art forms that, you know, you can apply to other art forms.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought about that a lot with literature and poetry too, and how different ideas about different forms of poetry, for example, could be applied to not the lyric writing, but the music of a song, which leads me to asking you, you've done a lot of visual art over the years as well, maybe even before you started playing music?
I mean, I always played music as a kid, but I thought for a long time, I thought that I was going to be a painter who had a hobby of playing music.
Yeah. Have methods crossed over, or have, you know, ways of thinking crossed over between the two ever?
Some. I mean, it's interesting because musical collaboration is very, very different for me than writing a song alone. Writing a song alone for me, it doesn't matter what the mood of the song is, it's like a melancholy experience. Not a bad one, but it's like being on a rowboat alone in a calm sea for me, you know? And it's not isolating, it's just me and myself and my thoughts, you know?
Yeah. Hmm.
And painting is totally like that. But collaborating musically, you get to sort of have the creativity and the song and the music come out, but it somehow skips that melancholy stuff. I feel like that's kind of, I don't think I could do what I do collaboratively without constantly going back to that lonely rowboat, you know, and being alone in that way.
Hmm.
But I think painting and art is this like the solitariest end of music.
Sometimes I think that when we talk about these ways of songwriting, I'm afraid that it can come off as too clinical or we're just doing science and not alchemy. But I found in our collaboration, my collaboration with Amy, which was really the first time that I ever wrote truly collaboratively with someone, you know, there were a couple of hurdles to get over in sort of not removing your soul from the process, but removing a certain amount of ego from the process so that you could simultaneously look at it as a puzzle to be solved and a piece of work to be made better through some of these specific forms and rituals. You've done some really deep collaborating with people as well. And I wonder how much that changes from artist to artist. Like, what's the breadth of we're just working on a puzzle or, you know, I'm really almost in the rowboat with you on this, you know?
It's really different from person to person. Partly even in my collaborative life, it's a lot of like probably half of my sessions throughout the year are people I am just meeting. Mm-hmm. And then like half of them are with people that I have worked with before. And with the person that I'm just meeting, one of the unknowns is whether they even really want to do it, which is weird because I feel like, why bother? But there's a certain amount of pressure. Oh, you better go over to Dan's and, you know, like make some music. Mm. And the person who is, like my assessment of myself is that in the music business, I'm like one of the hoarse, whispery, nicer kind of people don't leave in tears when I have a session, you know? Yeah. So if you're like an uncertain collaborator, I'm not going to humiliate you into writing a song. You know what I mean? So people at the labels or management think, oh, send person A who's very hesitant to Dan, who's nice. You know,
they won't, not a bad reputation to have.
It won't ruin their day, and they might feel better about like writing songs with other people.
Right.
And so I get from that to people who are like, I'm like, I would rather shoot the breeze for a while before even doing anything. But I do occasionally walk into a session with, say, a producer and an artist and me. And we walk in, we say, hi, what's up, and how's it going? And the producer goes, all right, check it out. And they like instantly, like 5 minutes into it, they're playing this track super loud. Oh, and we're supposed to go like, okay, I guess I have some ideas. Let me write in my journal. You know, I feel like that's not what I would want to do, but everybody's got their own crazy methods. And I tend to kind of like just be amazed and jump into it, whatever.
Are you able to come up with ideas under pressure, like right at the, like right now?
Well, not under pressure, but right now.
Yeah. Just right now.
But not under pressure. Yeah. Right. Like if, like I was just laughing with a friend of mine who's a really, really good songwriter and artist. And she was saying she recently had a session where the two other writers she was working with kept saying things like, I don't know, is this idea going to make us rich?
Oh my God.
Or they would say, it doesn't sound like a smash to me.
I hate
And my friend was saying, you know, there's nothing to her like more inhibiting than someone saying, is this going to make us rich? Because she immediately goes, maybe not. You know, and then like, it's probably not a good idea. Maybe it sucks, you know. A non-enriching idea.
I can't even imagine.
90% of the, what's of, the point? Of is this going to make you rich is how much money is already behind what you're doing. You
know? Well, that's a big part
exactly.
of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it depends on how much money people are going to spend to make it something. Yeah.
Well, I recently had a session with the person that I admire, and we wrote one unfinished thing that I liked a lot and one finished thing that I liked a lot. And when we finished sort of putting a demo together and listened to it, I said, this is amazing. I was so into it. And she goes, I think it's kind of an album track. I hope that's not a bummer to say. And I said, that depends. Let me think about that. Okay, let me ask you a question. With your other hits, blah, 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 these other hits, did you know right after you wrote them that they were hits? And she went, no, I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you can say this is an album track all you like then. Right. I don't care. You got to remember no one's assessment of like, this is going to make us rich. Oh, fine. You can say that all you like.
Right.
Yeah.
It's all random. Or not all.
It's not all random.
90% random.
Exactly. A lot of it is random. Yeah.
Yeah. You roll the dice every day all the time. You're going to roll some really good numbers, but it's still random.
Mm-hmm. I just can't even imagine writing. I can't imagine writing like that. I really can't. I mean, do you have a feeling about what is a pop, something that's going to go over on radio? Or write something, or can you, there's kind of a mode that you can get into?
No, I don't think that. I think, two answers. One is I do have a sense of when something is going to be a hit, but I never can apply it or tap into it at the right time.
Right.
My sense for what's going to be a hit is always comes in the form of like, this is amazing. Yeah, I love this so much. But it never occurs to me to go, and therefore it's going to be a hit.
Right.
You know, I don't ever go there. I forget.
You can't go, today is the day I'm going to really write the hit-like song.
No. And my one thing about my history is that I have been rewarded a bunch of times for writing things that even the people around me didn't assess as hits.
Yeah.
That no one thought my hits were going to be hits. They all kind of snuck their way into, well, wait a minute, this is the single. Whoa, okay, let's think about that.
Yeah.
They all sort of basically came from, like, I've never had a successful song where I had written it with like, I guess the kids like this bullshit. I'll do this.
Right.
You know, I never cynically have had anything successful happen. So none of the reinforcements in my life relate to the first part of that question.
Yeah.
That said, I love pop music and I love what's going on. And there's certain things that I hear that I go, well, I love that, but I can't contribute to that.
Yeah.
Like that strain of music is amazing. I listen to it all the time, but I'm not going to be the guy who's jumping in and
yeah,
like,
you don't intersect with that.
On the other hand, I can sort of siphon off some of the vibes of that if I like it and put it into things I'm working on. But also there's other things that I hear in the wider world and I'm like, oh, I could really help that person. I already can tell.
Mm.
I could be involved in that way.
Wow.
I could bring something useful. So that's my like ultra privileged circumstance. You know, I can't always like say, you, I'm going to write with you. You know what right. I mean? But to some degree, I can at least say, here's a bunch of things. Like, can we try reaching out to them?
Right.
And quite often someone will go, yeah, of course, let's do that.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I feel like I just have one speed. Like I got one speed and that's why I apply it to whatever project I'm working on.
But you have a, and I would say this about both of you, that when we're talking about or how we're defining knowing, you know, what's a hit,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
more about having a taste and a sense of what makes a quote unquote good pop song that is appealing to me.
To yourself.
The writer.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
And how to achieve yep. that, you know, yeah. for myself.
And how to be impatient enough with the outcomes you're working on to know that you still need to keep making it better.
Yeah.
And how to get also to a point where like, well, that's awesome. I'm done. You know, like mm-hmm. those are, all, that's all important, but it's not for me, not a thing. I know people who are like, well, I don't like it personally. I know people who would say, I don't like it personally, but people are going to like it.
Wow.
Hmm.
Yeah. That's not, I cannot do that.
I could see arriving at that point, having worked on something and being able to just have the perspective to understand that like, this is going to be for somebody, you know, this is going to work for somebody.
Maybe,
it's not
yeah.
necessarily my favorite thing I've ever
yeah.
done, but
yeah.
That's
yeah.
interesting. I don't think I have, I think I only know if it works for me.
Hmm.
I don't ever know if it works for anybody else. I have to let that go entirely.
It's a simplifying factor for you, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
One meter that you consult.
Yep.
Well, that reads pretty high. Okay, yeah. It must be good or
yeah.
not. But,
yeah.
you know.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with our guest, Dan Wilson.
Listen, we already know that you love genre movies, film craft, and female filmmakers. So, if you love all those things, then by transitive property, you love my podcast, Switchblade Sisters. Hi, I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I have a conversation with a different female filmmaker about their favorite genre film. Each episode covers the filmmaking process, working in the film industry, and just like general geeking out about awesome movies. I've had such great guests like the Big Sick writer Emily Gordon.
To me, indie movies as of late have come to be a catch-all term for a movie that kind of defies genre.
Billy Madison and Half-Baked director Tamara Davis.
When a comedian comes and enters onto my set, they're just there to be funny, and we're all ready and waiting for them to be funny.
Horror industry veteran and actor Barbara Crampton.
That's where real drama lies for me. What's between you and I speaking right now? Where are we meeting? And what's the energy that we create between us?
And so many others. So check out Switchblade Sisters every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's your relationship with perfectionism versus first draft? Who cares?
Well,
I'd say probably in lyrics, especially.
I can't always immediately generate a bunch of lyrics. I sometimes can do that.
Yeah.
And when I do that, I recognize that feeling, and then like I really clear everything out. If I'm with people, I'm like, just give me a minute because I have to, you know, I'm going to go outside or I'm going to, you know, go out to my car. I just have to like record a bunch of stuff or write it down or whatever it is. I can tell when that feeling is on me and I can channel a whole bunch of good lyrics. And then other times it doesn't happen like that, but I can, you know, the kind of conversation you have where the person keeps making you laugh because they keep referring to the thing you said an hour before.
Yeah.
And they keep making a reference to something you said and putting it in a new context or a new light. And it's such a sexy thing and great thing when someone does that in a witty way.
Yeah.
Callback.
Yeah, the calling back to the previous topic that seemed irrelevant, but it's not. Well, if I'm not in that sort of like channeling, flowing phase lyrically,
yeah,
I think I can kind of access a kind of musical equivalent to that conversational
right.
thing. Where stuff that randomly came up earlier in the day suddenly seems like a good metaphor for what's happening right now. Or something that somebody said at lunch suddenly is like, wait a minute, that thing they said would totally be great. And it works rhythmically. And then if you suggest it also, it's fun because then they realize that it's something they said, but it was just casual. That side can kind of take over.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah, that's nice. It's like, so you have your ear is sort of working to pick up little tidbits throughout the day, storing them up for you.
Maybe.
When you don't really even realize
it. Maybe subconsciously, you know, trying to. And also that has to do with a little bit with the found. Like if I have problems with writing words to a section of a song, I have a couple of books of Bob Dylan lyrics. I just open it up. And there's always some word that just shouldn't be in a song. In a Dylan song.
Yeah.
It's always got some phrase that
which
just
is nice.
Yeah. Makes you laugh out loud.
Yeah. Right.
Because no one else would ever have thought to put that in. And then at that moment, I'm like, well, maybe I'll steal that word from Dylan. That'll freshen things up for me, you know?
I've found it to be useful to be able to let go of my initial idea about where a song was even going lyrically. Mm-hmm. If you can find a phrase or a word or rhyme or, you know, a meter with something that might take you in a different direction to allow yourself to go with the form in that case and see where that takes you idea-wise.
One thing that I often find myself saying in sessions is people will say, is this a chorus? And I'll go, we don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
It could be. Well, let's try to beat it. Yeah. I really don't like to, like getting back to the Costello verse, pre-chorus, chorus, post-chorus hook thing. At this point, I try to avoid thinking of those terms. I want to write something that's like four kind of choruses in a row, each sort of different than the others, and see if that works.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, otherwise, like, I don't mind the Dylan-y, Tangled Up in Blue, like, or the Joni thing of just having a long kind of thing that ends with one phrase and continues and starts again.
Right.
Know?
I mean, take like Closing Time. It could be a series of choruses. You know, like you could see each of those sections working as a raising up from a previous, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Verse form or something.
That's true. I don't know if I was thinking consciously about that. But at the time, I when I was writing Closing Time, I had this experiment I was working on, which was putting the hooky part of the song into what people would call the verse.
Right, right.
So it would happen at the beginning. Like the title would be the first thing that you said in the song. And it's funny that people are like, I like it. I think it's a great thing to do, but I don't always do it. But I recently had a funny run-in with a label where I wrote a song. It was going to be the single. It sounded so great to me. And the label suddenly decided that the chorus was the first thing in the song. That was the hook of the song. So could we please edit it so that that was the last thing in the sequence instead of the first?
Wow.
And then we just went through this process of basically, to me, like just kind of ruining the song by finding the least interesting thing and putting it first. And that thing worked great as an answer to something great before it, the thing that became the verse. It was on some weird theory of like the least good part goes first and then you work your way up.
Well, it's also a real Lego theory of music. You know, I mean, one thing follows another thing for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, you, like you were saying with the playwriting, a certain climax or dire thing said earlier doesn't make any sense because you haven't earned that moment.
Right, exactly.
You know, there has to be something that leads to that moment. Maybe it's a increasing tension or maybe it's a lack of tension so that the dire thing really stands out. But you know, if you have dire, then no dire stands out.
Yeah.
Well, there's a funny thing going on right now in music because people are thinking theoretically, for example, about Spotify. And Spotify needs you to listen for 30 seconds for it to count as a listen.
Right.
And Spotify only needs the song to be like 2 minutes long or something like that. So in one way, people are trying to get like, okay, how do you keep people listening for 30 seconds? Well, you have someone besides the artist sing the whole first 30 seconds or say it. Then at the 31 second mark, you have the star start singing. Then you make sure the song is really short because if it's suddenly over, the person will be inclined to start from the beginning again and listen again. And now that counts as two listens. So like Stairway to Heaven is like in bad shape because in the time that you've listened to Stairway to Heaven, you could have listened to 4 2-minute songs or, you know, three of them.
Wow, I'm going to write a whole album of She Loves Yous.
Yeah.
Just in at the chorus.
Yeah, and
you're
done.
In, you know?
It's
get
so done. Strange. It's so tail wagging the dog.
Yeah.
Wow, it's all tail. There's no dog anymore.
No dog, yeah. Just that. Well, I've had people say, like, more and more people, a stock critique or praise even is like, well, the second half of that song is amazing. They'll say to me about something that I wrote.
Wow.
I think what they're subconsciously saying is, if only you had put the second half at the beginning and then gotten rid of the first half entirely, you know, that would work better on Spotify.
Wow. I feel like I'm in a different business.
This is where we're at.
Ted, you and I are not in the music business.
Well, I'm like,
I don't know what business it is.
We're in the podcasting business,
my friend.
Business
myself, at least I'm more into it than not, I guess.
I wonder how long people will have to listen to this podcast on Spotify for it to count.
At this point, actually, we don't care if they're still listening because we got past the 30-second mark. We're good.
Yeah, the first 30 seconds will be just, we have a great special guest. Yeah. The special guest is coming up. You won't believe your ears when you hear the special guest.
Who's it
His name
be?
Is, well...
I think you just made it to 17 seconds just now.
One of the questions I wanted to ask was about motivation, motivation to continue to write. I mean, obviously, you're hooked into a co-writing thing that's helps you make a living, which is not always the case with me and Ted. But I feel like, you know, people's motivation changes. You know, when you're young, a lot of it is like, I'll show them, or like, you know, I could do that, or, you know, I want to stand on stage and have people look at me, or, you know, whatever.
I'll show them.
I'll show them,
dude. I feel like I'll show them is totally...
That's a major,
you know,
that's up near the top of the list.
Yeah. So what were your, did you have some I'll show them?
I can dig it, but I think my I'll show them was in a different format in my brain. Like, early on, I think it was more like, you know, it was that thing we talked about earlier, like, I want to make one of those.
Yeah.
I want to have one of those for myself and my own band to play. Yeah. Like, literally just Picasso going to the Louvre, looking at Velázquez, going home and copying a whole bunch of Velázquez paintings from memory.
Yeah.
And making amazing Picassos. Like, I was trying to do a similar thing. Then when my band started to get opportunities to record, it was like this wonderland had, like, you know, appeared in front of me, and was so, like, magical. And I realized in my mind, it was like, oh, this must be why everyone does this, which actually isn't. It's more, I'll show them. But at that time, I really thought, oh, this is the gold mine. It's being in the studio. And then when people started like paying for studio sessions, I almost thought of the whole thing as this scam to get people to pay to put me in a studio and record.
Yeah.
Like the whole label thing was just, I'm writing a bunch of songs and making demos and I'm tricking them into spending a whole bunch of money for me to just be in the playground and record music.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was just purely fun.
Just for the curiosity and like learning how to do it. And, you know, sometimes very frustrating, but in Minnesota also there was a sort of maybe DIY element of it that was not helping us. Because we would have to reverse engineer and reinvent all these things that if we had just moved out here, everyone would know how to do in a heartbeat. And we could skip those days of pain, you know. But that was a big motivator. And I find now I just really enjoy that puzzle-solving element of it so much. And I do find it sort of miraculous that sometimes I can solve a puzzle and create an opening for all this kind of soulful, you know, breath of life to enter a song. It doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
But it happens often enough where I'm very motivated by, oh, that magic thing happened today.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to, for me to not want to do that again.
I feel you.
Yeah. That's the goal.
Yeah.
Is that a good place to end this?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Dan, thank you so much. This is really, really great to talk to you.
Totally a pleasure.
And we're huge fans of yours. And, you know, I mean,
likewise.
I really have admired your songwriting sense of melody for 30 years.
Nice.
we'll edit that out.
Yeah.
We'll
or
fix that in post.
For an amount of years that's fairly long, but not so long that we would be old.
Oh, thank you.
Dan, great. Thanks so much.
Thank you so
much. Yeah, total pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Art of Process.
Episodes will be arriving every other Monday.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you've been listening to, leave us a review. If you don't like it, don't review it. It's not, unless you think we're actively doing harm in the world, we don't really need your negative reviews.
You're very combative about the reviews. If you don't like it, keep it to yourself.
You know, I'm trying to not just be positive, but encourage positivity.
We're all about encouraging positivity.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.
Hold on, hold on, hold on. It's a podcast bonus. Yes, intrepid listeners of all kinds, from the casual to the superfan, of which I'm sure we already have many at this three-episode mile marker. You, all of you, are wise beyond your years, no matter how old you may be.
because you chose to lazily linger at whatever other task you were doing that prevented you from immediately smashing the pause or stop button after the little maximum fun bumper there, and thus, together, we are through the looking glass, where all time is one. Past is future, future is past. And so, you may remember earlier in the episode, my co-host, you might know her as my co-host, Amy Mann, mentioned hearing a song of Dan's that he played live when they shared a bill together about 35 years ago or thereabouts. Well, after the interview, we determined that the band was an old band of Dan's called Animal Dance, and the song was a song of theirs called Wonderland. And Dan, being the mensch that he is, went and dug up an old version of the song and sent it to us, allowing us to turn it around and offer it to you. And here is said song. May it ever be stuck in your great head as it has been stuck in the great Amy Mann's head. Wonderland by the great Dan Wilson.
Circles, unmarked in time.